John D. Rockefeller Sr. said, "A great responsibility rests upon newspapers. There is an ethical duty they owe to the community which I sometimes feel they regard too lightly. These stories about my wealth have a bad effect on a class of people with whom it is becoming difficult to deal. The stress which is laid in those stories arouses hatred and envy, not against the individual, but only against organized society. It is the general trend I have in mind which is arraying the masses against the classes." Well, John D., wherever you are, we'll do our best tonight on alternative views. Welcome to Alternative Views. Tonight, with the death of Nelson Rockefeller recently, we take a look at the vast empire of the Rockefellers, both historically, and we take a look at their activities. But before then, we go to the news as usual. Frank, for the first story.
Well, you remember a while back when Carter said, okay, nobody's going to get any more than 77% raise, and the corporate managers and the executive pay specialists were just aghast. But they're all smiles now. Because the old double standard's coming back into effect. The government workers, of course, they're, if they're lucky, they're going to get 7. The unions, they're settling for 7 many places. However, these rules aren't expected to disrupt most of the corporate compensation programs, because the companies are going to be allowed to decide how they want to divide up the company pot under this 7% guideline. Some executives can get more than 7, some less. And the administration is exempting from the bonus guidelines these bonus payments based on last year's performance. So the employers are given some flexibility to exempt subsequent bonuses if they're based on profit margins which prove unexpectedly high.
Unexpectedly.
Yeah. And it also allows employers to exclude from the guideline the effects in legitimate promotions and changes in workforce compensation. So now the businessmen are smiling again, and they're heaping praise in the White House on wage and price stability.
These are the same people that were asking us to tighten our belts here a few years ago and learn how to live with a reduced standard of living.
Yeah. Today we got two economists here with us, so I'm asking, what is the significance of this? There was a little mention in the Wall Street Journal that foreign holders of U.S. debt received $15 billion in interest in 1978. Does that have any particular significance as far as our economy or the continuing taking over of industries and land by foreign interests? Or does it have any significance that's been going on all these years?
Maybe for purposes of identification, joining us on the panel this evening is Harry Cleaver from the Economics Department for an encore performance. He really did a smashing job a few weeks ago when he came and talked about inflation. He's going to join us tonight talking about the Rockefellers.
Smash Rockefeller tonight. Yeah, no comments on the 18
well,
billion
interest? Yes, the interest primarily comes from U.S. government bonds, which are being sold abroad to finance the national debt. It's a new development, and they're being called Carter bonds. Many of them are being bonds are being sold for foreign currencies, and interest is being paid on that. The other part, interest can come from regular stock, stock holdings, other forms of non-governmental bonds, I suppose. But the outflow of debt itself, the payments on the debt, is to be expected from that.
Right.
From that.
Well, we're talking about Rockefeller, and that means millionaires. The spotlight had this report that in 1952 there were 13,000 billionaires. But in 1979, we have a quarter of a million of them. However, for a millionaire in 1979 to make as much as a millionaire in 1952, he would have to have $7,692,307.60.
And well, you're biting the bullet, aren't they?
Right. Well, over 50% of the millionaires are women, too, Frank.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. At least we discriminate on this program.
That's right. We have a media report here in just a second with Doug, but
I don't know if you have this one about William Buckley, you know, that
moral pontificator, you know, the guy with a big vocabulary.
One of the funniest stories I've read in a long time, but go ahead, Frank.
No, well, if you got it, go ahead. Okay, anyway, Buckley personally has to repay more than $600,000 to stockholders of a company, the Star Broadcasting Group, of which he was chairman. The Securities and Exchange Commission ruled that Buckley and other directors fleeced the stockholders for Buckley's personal expenses by employing devices, schemes, and artifices of fraud, and they made misstatements of facts and operated as a fraud and deceit in their manipulations of corporate property.
Well, he's a staunch defender of free enterprise, too, isn't he?
Basically, they were very inefficient. They lost a lot of money, and in order to cover their debts, they fleeced the stockholder. Buckley almost lost his entire fortune on this and said he's never going to get engaged in any business ventures again. This is pretty funny for someone who has been a high priest of private enterprise and all the benefits to the individual and the country. He himself nearly gets destroyed through his bad business practices.
I noticed that the title of that story, the headline is called Buckley Admits He's a Dummy.
I don't know. Well, see, the thing is, Buckley, they say there that Buckley says that he knows every word in the dictionary. But Buckley's defense on in this regard said, well, I didn't understand what the lawyers were saying, all those contracts. But anyway, what else happened in the media out there, Doug?
Well, there's certain processes are now underway which may radically change the structure and the nature of the American broadcasting system. For instance, the Carnegie Commission on the Future of Public Broadcasting filed a report recently after meeting for 18 months and proposed a larger budget of $1.2 billion a year to finance public broadcasting. This would mean there would be an average of $5 per person to fund the public broadcasting in America, and that this money would come from the networks and the broadcasters who would have to pay a spectrum fee for the use of the airwaves, which are said to be part of the public domain. What this would mean is two things, basically. One, there would be less centralization because there would be more programs produced, and therefore each local public broadcasting station would have more autonomy to choose from the programming. Hopefully, this would also mean better programming also, and in fact, on Sunday night, there was a new program on PBS shown called Nonfiction Television that had a documentary featuring Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang that was one of the most explosive and exciting documentaries I'd ever seen on television. So it's to be hoped that through better financing of documentaries and public television, that there will be better television in the American system. It's interesting that the Carnegie Report attacked very strongly the network television for its low-quality TV, failing to meet the public needs for information and quality entertainment. And there's been a whole raft of voices that have seconded this report. For instance, the FCC commissioner made a speech a couple weeks ago, Charles Ferris, urging that the government communication policy should further more diversity and should promote cable TV and new technology that would create more diverse and better innovative television. Interestingly enough, even the network executives themselves are aware that their days are perhaps numbered if they don't produce better television. Some ABC top executives the other day in this meeting told this convention that the network of the future would be mostly sports, news, and special events programs, and that entertainment would mostly be through video cassettes and special production companies. But perhaps the most interesting indication that the networks are aware of the low quality of their entertainment and the need for better quality television comes from none other than William Paley himself, who in his memoirs that are going to be published next week called As It Happens, makes the proposal that each network should put 2 hours a week aside for quality television production. Unfortunately, Paley has gotten a cold shoulder from the other network executives who don't want to sacrifice even 2 hours of their precious time for higher quality television. Anyway, there's interesting changes underway in the American TV system that we will keep you aware of and keep analyzing the failures or perhaps successes in the following days.
Doug, how significant an increase is it in the budget? You say that the proposed is $1.2 billion. What was it previously?
Well, previously it came to about $2.80 a year per person, whereas now it would be $5. So it's almost doubling the budget. So that's the most significant proposals that have ever been made for the funding of public broadcasting. And since President Carter argues that he's in favor of more money and better public broadcasting, this is encouraging. The question is, can they get the broadcasters to cough up the money through this spectrum fee? So far they're opposing it, but that the government can force it on them, which would make possible this better public television without any expense for the taxpayer.
I've got some labor news here, gleaned from several sources. In 1978, there were fewer strikes than there had been in the past. Well, actually, within 13 years. But these strikes were of longer duration. And there's still a lot of struggles going on. After 18 months of a fight, unionists won contract with Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Laredo. A GM plant in Shreveport is now unionized. It's part of a southern strategy of the union organizers. Efforts are going on in other plants all around the South. The next big one, big target, is Oklahoma City. There's a series of shipyard strikes, too, in Pennsylvania, two of them in Great Lake ports. These were all settled within that 7% guideline, but there's a contract in Lorain, Ohio, that was rejected. That strike's still going on. Perhaps the most significant one, historically, is the fact that undocumented workers have signed their first labor contract. An Arizona citrus farm grower, which is partly owned by the brother of Senator Goldwater, signed a contract with these undocumented workers. Lettuce workers are in strike in California. I guess that's getting a lot of play in the media. For some reason, they selected that one. The big strike in Newport News is still going on with the against the Tenneco shipyard there. And Harlan County, where that just mind-boggling movie was made. Harlan County, Kentucky, 14-month-old strike is still going on. Pickets are mostly women, it's been reported. There's a lot of violence, mainly from the scabs and the companies. A lot of shooting, dynamiting. Well, here's a question for the economists.
You already tried that
this
one.
This is the second one. I didn't like the real fast response.
If it doesn't work, float it again.
One of these guys,
okay.
The high priest.
What do you, now, you know the answer to this, I think, because I gave you what.
Well, let's hope so.
How much money do you suppose is estimated by the banks themselves that they spend each year in money speculation around the world? Remember that one? In 50 countries around the world, guess how much money they spend.
Is this a rhetorical question, or can I answer it?
Do you have any idea?
$50 trillion in the last year alone.
You remember.
Yeah, okay. $50 trillion in foreign currency speculation by the banks of the world. And remember, for those of you who can't remember, the GNP of the United States is roughly $2 trillion, so the potential, I think, for destabilization is certainly there at the least.
Well, you've got some more economic news. Since you answered the question correctly, sir, you've got to go on and give some economic news.
I get to go to the bathroom, too. Well, actually, my news is mostly Rockefeller news, and keeping in tone with the theme of the program. If for those few of you who have managed to hang with us here for these many months, you remember we did a program on the Trilateral Commission, and I believe it was brought out then that one of the central tenets of the Trilateral Commission, which is this think group, or how would you describe the Trilateral Commission?
Bunch of badasses.
Well, no, just a bunch of fun guys who get together and play cribbage and discuss controlling economic systems or something. Yeah. But one of the central tenets of the Trilateral Commission was to centralize economic decision-making and control over the economy. Of course, it's always done in our best interest to help get us through these rough spots, these things that keep happening, these recessions and depressions and what have you. And there are some of us who believe that the method of doing this is through the banks, and I mean primarily through banks who are promoting mergers. This is something that's very difficult to prove. Because of the confidentiality of most of the information you need to prove that there's something going on here. But at any rate, in the Wall Street Journal recently, we have a rather interesting article on one of the Rockefeller banks, Chemical Bank of New York, and its attempts to promote a merger between two of its clients, which, if it hadn't gotten messy, would have been, It would have been cut and dried, and it would have been finished with by now, but this is one of these so-called hostile takeovers. The problem here is that since Washington Steel and Tally Industries are both clients of Chemical Bank is in possession of some very, they stand a chance of making a big gain is what I'm trying to say, actually. They have an awful lot of inside information. Of course, the banks counter with the Chinese wall argument that, all right, we have trust departments who buy stocks for their clients. Of course, banks buy stocks, though this is a no-no. Banks buy stocks by creating Hickory Dickory Dock. Mm-hmm. Was it? Hickory Dickory Dock. Yeah, and all these fictitious street names. But they also have loan departments, and most of you, like myself, have been to the bank at some time or another, gotten a loan, and you know that you pretty much have to bare your bottom to them and tell them everything about you. Well, here we have a bank that is in possession of all the most secretive of financial data of these two companies, and they have a trust department who owns stock. And so the potential for conflict, of course, is fantastic. It's like leaving money laying around the streets expecting us not to pick it up. But at any rate, the banks counter that they have created an invisible Chinese wall. In other words, the people in the trust department never talk to the people in the loan department. Well, at any rate, some of the language in the article in the Wall Street was rather cute, and I thought I'd bring this out here. By the way, this was there was a judge who was basically, I guess, an orphans court judge in Washington County, PA, and he was interested in this Chinese wall idea, and he randomly, I guess, was assigned this case. Otherwise, I think the entire merger would have gone through, and nobody would have been the wiser. But this is the judge, I think, talking about the Chinese wall. A Chemical Bank's attorney argued that the bank has established a Chinese wall that effectively prevented the bank's Southwest regional manager, who is responsible for the Tally account, from getting any information about Washington Steel from the bank officer handling that account. But it was also disclosed that the two account managers met with an executive vice president of the bank who had overall responsibility for corporate loans in a five-minute meeting. Okay, we're talking about, you know, big bucks, about $70 million or so. We have a five-minute meeting of the executive vice president who authorized the Tally loan, and he authorized these people to go ahead and make the loan. The judge contended that a responsible bank vice president does not make a $70 million loan in 5 minutes. I think that's a reasonable assumption. Either Chemical Bank needs a new vice president or else the man has checked things out with his cohorts. But this thing's still going on, isn't it, Frank? By the way, Chemical Bank is a Rockefeller bank, and it was put together in 1955 as a result of a merger between the Chemical Corn Exchange and the New York Trust job.
You're going to get into some of that more later.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I've got a quote here. We got to have a quote for the day, and this is from the book The Rockefeller Syndrome by Ferdinand Lundberg. And you see, it's seen better days, so old John D., I guess. Anyway, he says, anybody who attempts to write realistically about the American political economic scene is going to find out that he's a muckraker.
How's that? Shall we muck a little rake?
Yeah, let's do some muck raking.
I like negative naysayers of negativism, actually.
Negative nabobs of negativism.
Remember that? Spiro Agnew? Whatever it was.
Well, what we would like to do tonight is to have an in-depth focus on the Rockefellers, seeing how they accrued their gigantic fortune, the historical development of their various diversification, starting off with a fortune in an oil monopoly, and then moving to the iron and the steel industries, and to diversifying holdings into control of banks, insurance companies, developing the modern conglomerate corporate political structure, and also playing a major role in the foreign policy. I'm going to begin with a brief historical analysis of how the Rockefellers first accrued their fortune. My source here is a book by Peter Collier and David Horowitz called The Rockefellers, which is an excellent historical account of the fortunes of the Rockefeller family from John D. to the present day. Now, John D. Rockefeller was the first to amass the family fortune, and of course is one of the most famous robber barons in the history of capitalism, and in the popular mind for many was the prototype of the capitalist. John D. was not simply a robber, however, but was the developer of a uniquely American institution, the trust, that became the prototype later for the corporation, the conglomerate, and then the multinational. Hence, whereas other robber barons were interested in swindles or monopolizing one corporation or simply in making a lot of money, Rockefeller was interested in evolving a whole corporate structure and financial empire. He got his beginnings in the Civil War when, in a grain commodity business, he made a lot of money and sniffed profits to be made in the new oil refinery industry. So he got more and more interested in the oil industry and started setting up refineries with other Cleveland businessmen. By 1870, he incorporated Standard Oil as the first major oil corporation. The way he was able to get a monopoly of the oil corporate field was through a very sophisticated process of rebates, where he made deals with the railroads to give him cutbacks on the rate and for ensuring a steady flow of oil on their lines, and was thus able to get better deals for than his competitors, which he drove out of business. The way he did this, and the final crushing blow, was developing what he called the South Improvement Company, where he made secret deals with the railroads, which raised the prices to carry the oil from the fields to the refineries, and then gave rebate to Rockefeller and his friends that drove most of his competitors out of business. It was at this time that Andrew Carnegie called Rockefeller Rockefeller, and the term octopus began to be used to describe the corporate structure of the Rockefellers. So by 1880, the Standard Oil controlled 95% of the oil produced, and it also won Rockefeller a lot of hatred, and he started getting heat from the government. The Pennsylvania legislature declared the South Improvement Company illegal. A lot of people who Rockefeller had driven out of business was suing him. He was getting a bad press, and there was a lot of uproar and antitrust agitation from the muckrakers. Well, Rockefeller then developed a new corporate structure, the trust, to diversify ownership, in which he put the ownership of the oil trust in different names and developed this incredibly complicated corporate structure to confuse the issue of ownership, which was a form, of course, of corporate conglomerate structure, which the Rockefeller heirs would perfect. Moreover, at this time, this is the 1880s, Rockefeller went into foreign oil in a big way and soon controlled the world market. The American government strongly supported Rockefeller's interventions in the foreign oil field, and when his massive China market was threatened by nationalist agitation, the Secretary of State, John Hay, issued the famous open door policy, which meant basically an open door for U.S. corporations to exploit foreign markets and the threat of military U.S. military force to back it up. So that in a sense, this is the beginning of a corporate imperialist foreign policy in the interests of the corporations. With the introduction of the automobile, the combustion engine, as well as airplanes, oil became one of the biggest commodities in the new industrial system, and with World War I, Rockefeller became tremendously famous. He started getting more and more heat, though, from muckrakers, and more agitation started to bust up Rockefeller's trust. So he began developing philanthropy. This actually went back to the early 1890s, where Rockefeller's religious conscience, he continually tithed 10% of his money, perhaps his guilt, as well as the desire to create a better public image, led him to hire a certain Reverend Fred T. Gates, who started a philanthropy foundation for Rockefeller. Well, this too led to increased fortune, as it turned out, for the Rockefellers, because Mr. Reverend Gates was able to acquire certain oil deposits in Minnesota and certain mines in Colorado that enabled Rockefeller to make deals with Carnegie and Morgan to establish the U.S. Steel Corporation, which again increased Rockefeller's corporate holdings. Moreover, Rockefeller seemed to succeed in this time with public relations through his philanthropy, whereas earlier in the days of the trust, in the early days of his amassing his fortune, he had a very bad public image as a greedy capitalist. With his philanthropy, people began to soften a little bit, and John D. Rockefeller's public image began to soften a little bit. Now, it was at this time that Rockefeller, around 1915, began to develop some problems with the labor movement. Jack, do you have a story on Rockefeller and the Ludlow mine strike in Colorado?
I better. I'm standing over here. Well, it seems that anyone who tuned in for our program a couple of weeks ago on labor history probably found out that we have a very bloody labor history in this country, and probably some of the bloodiest days of our history is the Ludlow, what has come to be called the Ludlow Massacre, Ludlow, Colorado. It seems that the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, which was Rockefeller dominated, would not allow the organization of the union. And in the fall of 1913, the workers went on strike to recognize the union. Now, that's the bad time to go on strike in Colorado. They were forced out of the company-owned housing, and I think we have a picture of the company-owned housing. This is not exactly spacious quarters and luxuriant quarters to begin with. But the Taj Mahal, compared to what they faced in the winter of 1913-1914,
we have here, I think, yes,
a tent colony. Now, can you imagine yourself in Colorado pitching tents, women and children? And that's the way they spent until April of 1914, when, I think I have another picture here, the Colorado militia. Now, the Colorado militia were not really a public body, publicly authorized body. There were people on the Rockefeller payroll who were put in militia uniforms. And on the morning of April 20th, 1914, they machine-gunned the tents. There had been a great deal of rancor and discord between, obviously, the strikers and the authorities, but they machine-gunned the tents and set fire to the tents with oil, burning 13 women and children and killing another 13 strikers, bringing a total of 26 strikers. This particular episode in American history earned Rockefeller the title of the most hated man in history.
And I think we have a shot here of the death pit itself, where 13 women and children died.
What happened was, these pits were anticipating there would be gunfire. These pits were built. And when they heard the machine gun fire, the women and children retreated into the pit, but they didn't anticipate that the guards would set it on fire. And there was a great deal of public outcry about this, but Rockefeller pretty much, John D. Sr. at least, defended his position. John D. Jr. Relented a little bit, but not so much that he would give in. President Wilson sent in troops in April of 1914. The troops stayed. The workers, facing another strike in December of 1914, gave up. The strike was broken, and they went back to work. Well, that's it, basically.
Okay, basically, Rockefeller Sr. refused to allow even the principle of unionization in his companies. John Jr. finally relented and allowed what was later called company unions to be founded, in which a group of people in each corporation, consisting of the corporate managers and some workers, would from time to time get together and discuss problems and grievances. But the Rockefellers opposed unionization constantly. Now, as an aftermath of the murder of all the workers in Colorado, Rockefeller Jr. was called up before the Industrial Relations Commission in Congress in 1915 and questioned as to his policy there. And it's interesting that a union leader, John Lawson of the United Mine Workers, said, "It's not their money that these lords of commercialized virtue are spending, but the withheld wages of the American working class. Help for China, a refuge for birds, pensions for New York widows, and never a thought of a dollar for the thousands that starved in Colorado." The point he was making was that the philanthropy of the Rockefellers that was so widely publicized was financed from the low wages that were paid to the workers. Anyway,
Doug, excuse me, you said he was called in front of a committee. Whatever came of it?
Mainly he got a tongue lashing at this committee that was run by this guy named Walsh, but nothing really came out of it in terms of legislation or any improvements in the workers' condition. Now Harry Cleaver is going to tell us how Rockefeller's policy of philanthropy in the South was the model for the program in the foreign policy interventions that the Rockefeller family would later do in their so-called underdevelopment policies. Harry, would you like to begin?
Well, I suppose that nothing is easier than to paint the Rockefellers as villains when it comes to business. More problematic are indeed the philanthropies, because there was much more to them than simply creating an image behind which Rockefeller could carry out his illegal and, in the case of the Ludlow Massacre's deadly business practices. Around the turn of the century, Rockefeller was involved in setting up a number of philanthropies, and they operated primarily in the South. The General Education Board was set up in 1902. The Rockefeller Sanitary Commission was set up in 1910. And
The Rockefeller Sanitary Commission?
Yes, the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission, which is not a joke, because during the late 19th century and early 20th century, the South had a major problem with hookworm, which is a virulent, debilitating disease in which your intestinal system gets full of parasites.
It's from walking barefoot, right?
That's right. It's similar to schistosomiasis in the Third World. Thanks to the Rockefeller's expenditures and the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission, hookworm was all but eliminated in the United States. The intervention through the General Education Board was the essential force which created public education in the South, the United States. And third, the interventions of the Rockefellers into agriculture through supporting Seaman Knapp's farm demonstration programs led directly to the Agricultural Extension Service of the Department of Agriculture. In these three areas then, agriculture, health, and education, Rockefeller, through the philanthropies, made a major intervention into Southern society. In a way which one can hardly dispute brought great benefits to the people of the South. Now, the reasons for it, of course, are somewhat different. One doesn't have to seek purely humanitarian reasons for these interventions, because, in fact, the architects of these interventions were conscious of the fact that what they were doing was engineering a social transformation of the South to knit it into the larger emerging national economy. And the intervention in education, in health, and indeed in the farms, was designed to transform the nature of the labor force, to make it more healthy, more productive, more skilled, so that it could be integrated into the emerging industries in the South, in which, of course, Rockefeller and friends had considerable interest. Well, effectively, this was the first intervention of the Rockefellers, and indeed of U.S. policymakers in an underdeveloped country, because the South was very much an underdeveloped country at the time. And it lay the basis for their subsequent interventions in other parts of the world. Primarily, in the 20s and in the 30s, was the intervention into China. It can be said that in the case of China, despite the American open-door policy, American government had no China policy. Its only policy consisted of trying to make sure that American banks, including the Rockefellers, got their share of the loans from the Chinese that were given to the Chinese government. In other words, to make interest, the kinds of interest, Frank, that you were asking about in the case of the U.S. a little while ago. The major way of exploiting China at that time was to loan money to the governments and then be paid back with interest. And that interest was extracted from the Chinese people. All right? That was the basic, the limits of American foreign policy, not for the Rockefellers. Rockefellers went in first in supporting missionaries and then with their own programs to try to transform Chinese agriculture, create a Chinese educational system, and to improve the health in China. In other words, they reproduced in China all of the programs that they had used in the South, that they had developed in the South. And in fact, they used to bring the Chinese who were being trained for these programs back to the South to observe the programs that they had set up there. All right, those programs in China were very progressive. Nobody else was doing anything like it, except, of course, the communists. There was, as you know, for 40 years, there was a growing revolution in China. The Chinese Chinese communists of one sort and another were very much interested in the transformation of the countryside against the kind of quasi-feudal, quasi-capitalist social structure that existed at the time. And the Rockefellers were intervening in order to offset their influence. In fact, they intervened in order to do what they called setting up a third force. A third force was supposed to be between Chiang Kai-shek, who emerged as a leader of the nationalists, and the warlords that supported him, and the communists. A progressive elite who could bring about reform in the countryside and undermine the influence of the communists on the one hand, and on the other hand, open up China to cooperation with Western business in a way that had never happened before. So that the experience in the South was fundamental in that policy. And that policy, despite the fact that China was lost, was the basic lesson, laid the basic lesson for American foreign policy in the post-war period. Namely, the need to intervene in the Third World to stabilize the countryside, to avert revolution and make the world safe for multinational corporations and investment.
Harry, wouldn't you say that the Rockefellers were the most class-conscious capitalists who were aware that if they didn't develop a progressive industrial structure, social structure, in the Third World countries, that they would be, quote, lost to communism? This is the sense that I get from at least their Latin American interventions, that when Nelson and John Jr. went down there to investigate the oil in Venezuela and the whole social structure of Latin America, they became very aware, before any other capitalist did, of the necessity of developing social programs that would aid in capitalist development in these countries. Isn't this the case, that they're the most class-conscious capitalists, and that this is the mark of the Rockefellers in both their domestic and foreign policy?
Yes, that's very true. Although in this period, most of this work overseas was being carried out by the Rockefeller Foundation in the 20s and in the 30s. In the late 30s and 40s, this work by the foundation, which was mainly run by John D. Rockefeller II and then John D. Rockefeller III, was supplemented by the activities of Nelson Rockefeller. In fact, and this is very important to see, the sophistication of these people. In 1939, when the Mexicans nationalized the Rockefeller oil interest in Mexico, the company screamed its head off. Standard Oil would have had government intervention, boycotts against Mexico, and send in the Marines if they could have acquired it. At the same time, Nelson goes down and negotiates a settlement with Cardenas, the president of Mexico, spends the night with him in Mexico, and comes back with an understanding of the rise of nationalism in Latin America and the need to use social programs to take a conciliatory approach in order to undermine that growing nationalism. In other words, not to respond with a big stick, but to respond in a cooperative kind of way, to use the carrot, to make the make American wealth essential to the stability of Latin America, rather than using the old club that is characteristic of the imperialist period.
Okay, well, thank you, Harry. Now, as an introduction to our analysis of the Rockefeller family's present economic holdings and foreign policies, I might note that the Rockefeller Trust, the Standard Oil Trust, was first busted by Teddy Roosevelt in the so-called trust-busting administration at the turn of the century, and forced Standard Oil to diversify. However, what this meant in practice was there were many different owners now of the Standard Oil of New Jersey, of Pennsylvania, of New York, etc., that maintained a loose cartel under Rockefeller directorship. Moreover, at this time, the Rockefellers actually benefited from the trust busting because they began diversifying their holdings and developed a set of strong financial institutions such as the Chase Manhattan Bank, through which they were able to evolve their corporate conglomerate and multinational structures, and also use this as the basis for increased political power. So the genealogy of the Rockefellers was, after John Sr. gave over the Standard Oil Corporation to John Jr., he diversified the holdings even more into iron, into coal, and made some deals with Carnegie to set up the United Steel Corporation, made some deals with his former enemies, Morgan, so that when John Jr. was able to give his empire to his five children, people like David and Nelson and Winthrop, et cetera, they were able to have a tremendous set of holdings, economic holdings of the most diverse sort. And I take it Al is going to analyze some of the current economic holdings now of the Rockefellers.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Doug. The whole idea, a lot of people really don't know what the Rockefellers do for a living, and sometimes it's kind of hard to determine exactly what sort of productive endeavors that they are engaged in. They're really not your basic mom-and-pop grocery store owners, that's for sure. As Doug has mentioned, they were into oil, basically. But I think it's sort of along the lines of a pyramiding scheme. If you can control a corporation by controlling just a small segment of its stock, that's one thing. But if you have a bank, which through its trust departments has lots of stock and lots of companies, you can centralize your control. And this is exactly what the Rockefellers, as well as, I guess, the other 10 or 12 wealthy, mega wealthy families in the United States learned many years ago, that you can control the corporations of the United States better, more efficiently, cheaper, the whole bit, by controlling a few financial institutions. Now, just to give an example of what I'm talking about, the financial institutions that are known or called as the core Rockefeller group, these are ones that are either founded by Rockefellers or Rockefeller people are on the board of directors. Just the ones that are in this central core consist of Chase Manhattan, assets $45 billion, First National City, $64 billion. These are the second and third biggest banks in the United States. Chemical Bank of New York, First National Bank of Chicago, the Metropolitan Insurance Company, Equitable Insurance Company, and New York Life Insurance Company. The total assets of these seven institutions is $230 billion. A lot of people don't understand the importance of the insurance companies in this control over the economy. And insurance companies are basically net long-term lenders in the market, while banks lend short to medium terms. But the whole idea is that if you control the board of directors, you can control the company. These banks, in turn, and these families, in turn, also form alliances with other families and banks and institutions throughout the United States. Carnegie might have called Rockefeller Rockefeller, but his daughter Nancy married a Rockefeller.
Maybe call him that after he got married.
So. Yeah. Now, the importance of the New York, the centralization of control in New York, is that New York is basically the wholesale banking capital of the world. What I'm talking about is that New York banks primarily lend money not to you and I to get car loans, but to businesses to take over other businesses or for expansion or for any sort of thing dealing with business purposes. Also, New York is the underwriting capital, I guess, of the country. In other words, all the new stock issues. to give an example of some of the companies that are under the wings of the Rockefeller institutions, either through bank holdings, trust departments, or interlocking directorates, or families that are aligned with the Rockefellers and their holdings. We have DuPont, W.R. Gracie, Corning Owens, Hewlett-Packard, Pittsburgh Coke. I'm just concentrating on ones that you might have heard of. Standard Oil, Mobil, Standard of California, Standard of Indiana, International Harvester, Inland Steel, Marathon, Quaker, Wheeling-Pittsburgh.
Al, don't they also have
most of the major airlines, a number of the utilities? Con Edison is I guess it's reasonable to say Con Edison is controlled by Rockefellers. At one time, the Rockefeller institutions also had 40% of the board of directors of AT&T.
Al, don't they also have these things called dummy holding companies in which there's anonymous so-called stock ownership of many corporations that
Street
they
names.
Wield? That they wield a power in the corporate policies of corporations that we don't even know about
right.
through their holdings.
I think going back to the Glass-Steagall Act, the government was interested in keeping banks from doing what they had done in the 20s, which helped push us into the Depression. So they made a law that banks cannot own common stock. But they've gotten around this through the years by creating fictitious corporations, dummy corporations, as we were Jack and I were talking about earlier. Hickory Dickory Dock is one. And these dummy corporations, they exist only on paper. These dummy corporations, in turn, own common stock. I think Northern Industries, one of the big conglomerates, about 30% of its common stock is owned by dummy corporations. ABC, NBC, and CBS are also controlled in this fashion.
Al, what difference does it make whether or not the control is concentrated in this fashion?
What do you mean?
Difference does it make whether or not these corporations are controlled by a series of independent capitalists or whether or not it's controlled by a single family?
I don't think I understand exactly what you mean.
Well, you mean whether they're a whole bunch of little capitalists in a competitive situation
where
a few people can control and direct things, and well, it also relates into what I'm going to talk about also, which is political control,
the concentration of so much power enables them to control both economic and political processes.
Yeah, but more importantly, I think the access to credit is not traditionally used as an input in most models, but it is the most important input in the economy. And if you control the access to credit, you have the potential for controlling the economy. But
as well as the labor force. Take New York City and Cleveland, for instance. If you have a few corporations controlling the political and economic processes of big cities, then they wield tremendous power over them. And we've seen that in the New York City financial crisis, and we see this going on in Cleveland now. And it's no accident that it is banks and insurance companies that are playing a major role in the control of these cities. So I think that this is bad for the working class. And to develop any sort of progressive politics, either on the local level or the national level, if you have such a tremendous concentration of power and wealth.
Which, do you have any more to add on that? Because that leads into what I was going to talk about the political power of the Rockefeller Group in connection with the Morgans. They are pretty much one pot anymore, although some of them have basic control of certain financial institutions and others have control of others. But taking this Rockefeller Financial Group publication here, which Al was looking at a while ago, it also has a list of the prime Rockefeller people who are involved in government. For instance, they have a list of 32 men, and they've held 73 positions, very high positions in government. For instance, 15 secretaries or undersecretaries of state, secretaries of defense or assistant deputy secretaries of defense, 5, and on down the line.
Frank, these came out of the Rockefeller Foundation, a lot of these people, so this is, again, a political payoff from their philanthropy.
Well, these are the, speaking of the foundations, there's another list which shows the relationship between foundations, think tanks, and universities. And of the list of 35 of the top Rockefeller people, they have sit on boards of trustees of 20 foundations or funds. Universities, the elite universities of the country, 27, think tanks, 9, etc. But this is just a small part of it. When you start looking at the organizations which they control, and which relate then into foreign policy and domestic policy, then you can get the real impact of the, you might call it the American ruling cartel. We did a program previously about the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission, and periodically we mentioned the Council of Foreign Relations, which is an extremely important group of top business leaders and financial leaders from the New York area, which once again equates to the Rockefeller Morgan Group. The Council of Foreign Relations was really started back at the end of World War I, but didn't come into its own really until the start of World War II. It's comprised of people. First, it was restricted to the top businessmen and financial leaders of Wall Street within a 50-mile radius of New York. It isn't quite that restricted anymore, but still it's mainly the New York, the Wall Street bankers and lawyers who control the steering and advisory committees of it. What they have done over the years is basically to do several things. First, set U.S. foreign policy. Second, determine what is acceptable in the way of policies and what is discussable in the proper governmental circles. They've also been very important in the determining a consensus and eliciting a consensus from the upper class, particularly the large corporations and the American upper class.
Now, when I say they largely determine foreign policy, there's a tremendous book that's just come out called Imperial Brain Trust by Shoup and Minter. It talks about the Council of Foreign Relations, and it indicates that starting World War II, before the U.S. entrance into it, the Council of Foreign Relations had some discussion groups, and these discussion groups in turn influenced government, because there were people from the Council of Foreign Relations who were in top government posts, and these people were listening to their fellows in the Council of Foreign Relations. So much of our foreign policy, which ended in us getting into World War II against the Japanese, was a direct result of the policy set in the Council of Foreign Relations. Then during the war, the planning for a post-war period once again was done mainly in the Council of Foreign Relations, and it became so closely allied with the State Department that they actually moved offices into the State Department, and the study groups, once again, the output of this actually became foreign policy in the United States. So they not only just the immediate post-war policy, but also the extended post-war policy, including the policy toward Vietnam, Guatemala, and Cuba, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. These ideas were hatched from the Council of Foreign Relations and accepted by the U.S. government. When the government would have various special advisors, most of these people would be from the Council of Foreign Relations. Right now, there is a study, a 1980s project study going on, which they're determining what the entire international system will be, planning a new world order in which the United States will share power with some of its capitalist friends around the world. Now, the Council of Foreign
Relations... Frank, can I intervene? Mm-hmm. Maybe this is on a follow-up question to Harry's. Harry Magdoff, the author of The Age of Imperialism, argues that in a capitalist society, that imperialism is not a matter of choice, it's a way of life and necessity. How would other capitalists, small-time capitalists, independent capitalists, plural capitalists, have brought about a different policy outcome as regards to the entrance into World War II or other interventions in foreign affairs?
Well, if you look at the... For instance, you might say that if the Council of Foreign Relations and their outward imperialistic outlook had it not been effective, and had they not had so many people from the Council of Foreign Relations and their sympathizers in the government, it might have belled then that the Alf Landons, the isolationists, might have had greater influence in the government. Secondly, there was a great period right after the war in which the Morgenthau Plan, which was wanting a rather severe peace levied on Germany to not let them come back industrially, to make them an agrarian state. And this was accepted by Roosevelt at first, until finally significant pressure was put on by the Council of Foreign Relations and this policy was changed. So I think that mainly it would indicate that the more moderate wing of the ruling class had its way rather than the more conservative. The National Association of Manufacturers or the would have had its way.
I think also structurally it makes it possible to have a unified foreign policy, because if you had individual capitalists each pursuing their own special economic interests, they would be squabbling among themselves all the time. They would never be able to get any sort of unified foreign policy or even domestic policy. So the fact of having this tremendous concentration of economic and political power centered around the Rockefellers and their various corporations and groups makes it possible to have something of a unified thrust in foreign and dimension policy that wouldn't be possible without this form of organization that's made possible by their concentrations of power.
And it makes it much easier for them to plan. As we see now, they've gotten not just national from a national basis, but an international basis. This brings us to the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. Now, the Bilderbergers is a super secret organization which includes not only the top U.S. industrialists and financial people, but also their counterparts in the Western capitalist world, particularly the NATO countries. This has been meeting since 1954, and I said in secrecy. They may take great pains to make sure that nobody knows about it, even though that there have been representatives from the establishment press in these meetings. Very, very little has ever come out about it. Not only are the industrialists and the bankers there, but also selected academicians, government people, many of them who did not become heads of their government until after they attended Bilderberger meetings, and some of them attended Bilderberger meetings afterward. It's very interesting that the Council of Foreign Relations, the head man in that is David Rockefeller. The head man at the Bilderbergers is also David Rockefeller. And the top man of the Trilateral Commission is David Rockefeller. Now, the Trilateral Commission is a recognition that they needed to bring Japan in on this international consensus to try to eliminate rough spots and competition wherever necessary and cooperate in controlling the Third World. Japan is strong enough now, so they recognize this. Well, at a Bilderberg meeting, Brzezinski and David Rockefeller broached the subject. They thought it was a good idea, so they did set it up. And so now we have the Bilderbergers in a way, kind of the Trilateral Commission is kind of the Bilderbergers out of a closet, plus Japan. Perhaps the most blatant power play has been the selection of Carter to be President of the United States. He was a Trilateral Commissioner, so is the Vice President. And as we show here, 24 members, at least 24 members of the Carter cabinet are from the Trilateral Commission, which shows that they're not just kind of sitting in the background and letting their representatives run the government like they did several years ago, but they actually are doing it on a very concerted and definite basis. And as I said, David Rockefeller is the head of the Trilateral Commission. So then we look over the years now at who have been the prime people in the U.S. government. We take a look at the Secretaries of State. As you see, a CFR means a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, a B means the Bilderberger, and TLC is Trilateral Commission. So if we scan down the names of Secretaries of State, Secretaries of Defense, Treasury, CIA, Special Advisors on National Security, we find the same people popping up time and again, regardless of party affiliation, regardless of the whoever is in power. Actually, it's the same person in power.
This is basically the private government that runs things.
Right. So when you talk about the business, you talk about government, you're talking about basically the same thing.
Gee, we're running out of government. We're running out of time.
I think you should just say that these are the people who try to run things.
Right.
Because at the present time, the Trilateral Commission was put together in order to come up with policy solutions to the current international economic crisis, and it so far failed to find a solution. Mm-hmm. So trying to plan the world
Why should
economy,
they try to find a solution
trying
if they
to
can
find
make
a
money?
Solution doesn't necessarily mean that they always do it.
Well, why should they try to find a solution if they can make money either way? It doesn't matter if Iran is communist or anarchist. You know, the oil companies are still going to charge what they want anyway.
Well, that will be seen. I mean, they're in an incredible state of anguish right now about Iran because they're afraid that they're going to lose control of the oil there.
Well, I've got a lot of anguish because I wish we had more time to discuss that. But we've got to sign off now except for a bedtime story.
Thank you, Frank. This will make some sense of what happened at Ludlow. In 1914, a Popular Science monthly issue by Professor John J. Stevenson, which he wrote, "A wife and children cannot be considered in connection with the relations of a wage earner to a wage payer. If a man's services are not worth enough to secure wages which would support a family, he shouldn't marry. One is told that in each year, 200,000 women in our land are compelled to sell their bodies to procure the necessaries of life, and that each year sees 700,000 children perish because their parents had insufficient nourishment. If it be true, one must coincide that their deaths are a blessing to themselves and to the community. Such children should not have been born." This article was praised by John D. Rockefeller, Jr. as one of the soundest, clearest, and most forceful pronouncements he had ever read, and recommended its use.
Capitalist philanthropy.
See you next week. Thanks for tuning in.